Indeed, that's excellent drafting. But we'll just check that for you. We can do that. Right. Thank you, Chair. If self-explanatory, so is G, it's the disqualification of membership. Just to highlight footnote 44, disqualification of public servants for appointment as members is strictly speaking still pending in final decision by the committee.
I cannot say
the
disqualification of
members
is
what I want to offer is that the public servants can be eligible provided they resign from the public service upon appointment. And so it could read as you wish. If a public servant or the holder of any other remunerated position, unless he or she resigns from the public service or public body upon appointment. Actually, not so standard if you think of the other chapter 9s, but it's certainly standard outside. And it's always it's a factor of the independence, you know?
No.
Yeah.
They are on the list and we don't have a provision that when they are elected and before they are sworn in,
they issue
disqualification comes into play and they need to resign.
That's right.
They need to be qualified at the time of appointment.
That's right. Now, what I'm offering is that we make that applicable here. Usually, the greater the degree of independence you want for a body, the more you would resist having any line function ministry appointees. But I think in this case, and I'm very happy to say we can do this.
Yeah, I mean, I like the option of exclusion to remain.
But the issue that Dean raises, I mean, it would be, I don't know if that's necessary because it's at the time of appointment. So obviously, in order to, if you keep this restriction, a public servant can resign and be appointed. As a member of a council or a legislature can resign and be appointed. It doesn't mean when they apply that they can't even apply because they might not want to resign in case they don't get the job.
You don't want to spell it out. But you're doing all the bureaucracy stuff that you're having, your whole problem is there and telecom in the line ministry, which is constantly trying to. So you spell it out.
Yeah, I think it's clear. I mean, it's the same one applies to three. You can be a member of parliament and apply, and then as long as you resign before you get appointed, you can be appointed. I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, I think I've covered that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So should we reinsert that?
No, keep it as it is. It's an option. I mean, I want to keep the option of whether to allow public servants to become members of the regulator. I'm not here. Yeah.
Rest, nothing report there, Chair. Sub-clause 2 on page 28. Those amendments are in line with the request by the Technical Committee that the National Assembly and the President should be involved in the appointment of the members. So the procedure is then spelled out in sub 2.
That's per constitution, but not in addition, there's a case where we can
So it will be very clear to the committee during the selection of recommendation which one it is that we're thinking of as a cap. And I think we should do it. I think we should write it in. In 2A, members of the regulator refer to what they must be put in front on the recommendation of the National Assembly. And we should say, members, the chair, chairperson, and members of the regulator. Be by the president of the recommendation of the on the recommendation.
I think if you can have that as an option, I mean, we just appointed the IEC, and the president appoints the chair and the deputy chair. Yeah.
And our recommendation in the CAP 9 review, by the way, overall, February 10th, was that this body should be linked to the other. But that clearly, you want to come standardized, it's worth the whole thing with each body.
But can you, can you have it as the president as the IEC, the president's point, or an option for the National Assembly?
Thank you, Chair. Paragraph B, nothing special there. Sub 3 have remained unchanged. Sub 4 is the exclusion where the chairperson or the full-time members may, with the permission of the minister, the prior permission of the minister, hold an office or perform other remunerative work. So 5 deals with...
Why 3 months? Why not just say no resign? What happens if someone's gone horribly wrong, they don't resign on the spot? Wasn't there before? Could have been 3 months an hour, and it's just 3 months.
Well, I think that's to make it possible for the relevant
conditions.
No,
it's not easy, but you may have a situation where they have to resign on the spot.
Yeah.
They have been processing people's personal information.
Yes, Chair, I think generally you do have your exceptions, and they are most probably provided for under vacancies. But one wouldn't necessarily want a vexatious member to all of a sudden create a crisis within the operations of the regulator.
I don't think that there is such a requirement even for Director Generals. Director General wants to resign or resigns. Am I wrong? I mean, the fact is that if a guy wants to leave, the sooner he leaves, the better it is. And having a legal provision which forces him not to leave when he's doing something else, I think is destructive.
I'm very familiar with this formulation, for whatever reason.
Yes, we're at the mercy of the committee at this stage. I could just possibly mention that even immediate resignation is, strictly speaking, not possible because it is subject to approval by, for example, the DG example, by your minister. I can really not see that any person, especially at the level of a DG, can decide one morning that I'm not going to work tomorrow anymore. It's just, and of course, the extra or the most important factor associated with that, even if it is allowed, you still have a large pool of experienced people to be immediately appointed as acting. We do not necessarily have an acting appointment procedure here.
Which other or SABC board?
What are 3 months if I'm
3 months.
I
That was memory serves. Yes, check.
Can you check on this and maybe just do a quick note for the to alert us that there may be an issue on the Phoenix? I see the harm you're trying to create. They could drop dead today, and then the thing is vacant anyway. Whereas, as Dr. Ambrosini said, if they decided they want to go, if they're willing to serve notice, fine, some are, you know, it's not a big issue. But if there's been some major internal dispute, when they've fallen out with the chair or something like that, then let's say the chair has fallen out with the other three members of the regulator, and they've decided, no, they don't want to stay.
I don't want to label that matter, Jay, but one should also consider that it's not fair, the example just given, towards the individual as well. If I'm pushed out of the regulator as a member, I should at least be allowed 3 months after I've committed myself for 4 or 5 years to get my business in order before I'm basically left on the street.
And walk out immediately. He can't quit and walk out.
Look, as I said, check on the other one. Definitely your category where
there's pressure and they get forced to resign. Well, it's up to them. They can say I'll resign in 3 months or whatever. But what we want to provide for is the situation where the person has had enough, they want to go now, maybe because they've fallen out with everybody else on the regulator. Why must they hang around for 3 months?
May I just, and really I apologize for this, but I just need to satisfy myself. We must take into consideration that the president appoints members. And do we really want to create a crisis for our president of the republic to be able to, today I resign, tomorrow, you know, the president approaches parliament and say, but I need this whole process to get quickly off the ground. Granted, sir. But generally we expect that people in good health will be appointed. Yeah, thank you. I've given it my all. We'll look at it for you. sub 6. Yeah.
So you've taken out the age restriction.
Yes, Jeff. See, because I think we've got a much more appropriate provision dealing with the inability of the person.
Okay.
Of so mine.
A lot more
like, Chair, so under 6, we have the grounds for removal from office. And then the procedure there in B and C.
That looks straight from 194.
Thank you, Chair. Perfect. Clause 37 deals with vacancies and provides us with an indication when a vacancy occurs and how that vacancy should be filled. Strictly speaking, the same procedure as the nomination of members, excepting the important part in 37.2b, any member appointed under this subsection holds office for the rest of the period of the predecessor's term of office, unless the President, following approval by the National Assembly, directs that such member hold office for a longer period.
It should be the other way around. unless the President, upon the recommendation of the National Assembly, appoints that member for a longer period, which may not exceed one subsequent term. The whole idea here is that the Assembly chooses these people. And we can't now suddenly have the President, he only signs on the dotted line. We can't now suddenly have him saying, oh, but I like this cadre, I'll give him an extra term, and then send it back to us, because procedurally he would then have to literally send it back to the National Assembly, the way you've written it, following approval by the National. Then we'd have to vote all over again on this person, who is then not voted, because we'd first take a vote on the unexpired portion of the term, then it goes to the President, then the President said, oh, I like this one, let's have him for another term, which is contrary to the perception of independence, and then it would have to go back to the Assembly, and where we would take a second vote on whether he can do not just the unexpired portion, but also the next term. It just doesn't work logistically, and it's also bad in principle. So just change it to, unless the President, upon the recommendation of NA, appoints such member for a longer period, which may not exceed.
Is it not that this which may not exceed 5 years? I mean, if the President, if the president on the recommendation of the National Assembly wants to reappoint them, that's fine.
No, this is a vacancy.
Yes, I know this is a vacancy, but the period for which they may be appointed, the maximum period is 5 years.
Yeah.
They fall under sub 36(3), and upon the expiration of that period, they may be eligible for reappointment.
But the president
is not going to be appointed by an expired
portion.
Yeah, no, it's not necessarily. I mean, if you look at the Human Rights Commission, because it's not a bad thing to the IEC, for example, that you don't sort of appoint everybody at the same time. You've got continuity. So I would have thought, I mean, it's optional anyway, and power is with the Assembly. I agree with Dean's point about the recommendation, the wording, but it's unless that it's directed that the member holds office for a longer period than the expired portion, but that period may not exceed 5 years. Is that so? That's what's happening with IEC, that's what's happening with the Human Rights Commission. So, you know, IEC, we appointed four, because we already had we already changed the judge earlier. Human Rights Commission, we appointed at different times, and it's quite good because you have then some kind of institutional memory staying on. But here we're not saying it must be 5 years. It's optional on the Assembly, the principle is optional on the Assembly.
Maybe just for clarity then, so the last portion of the subclause will redirect that such member holds office for the expired period.
It holds office for the rest of the period of the predecessor's term, unless the Assembly or whatever the Dean's wording was directs that the member then holds office for a longer period, which may not exceed 5 years.
Or if it's continued, any member appointed under the subject in both office for the rest of the period of the predecessor's term of office, or a period of 5 years.
Or a longer period.
Or
I don't know why one would want to say 4 years.
Not exceeding 5 years. Or a longer period, not exceeding 5 years.
That's
right.
Your
Chair, on the next page, clause 38 deals with the powers, duties and functions of the chairperson and the other members. This is also as a result of discussions of the previous technical committee. Under sub 1, the chairperson must exercise its powers and perform its duties and functions conferred or assigned to him or her by the regulator in terms of this Act or the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And he's for the purposes of exercising those powers, performing those duties and functions conferred on or assigned to him or her by the regulator, in terms of this Act and the Promotion of Access to Information Act, accountable to the regulator. The important part is now sub 2, Chair, where it is now required you will remember that we referred to clause 36D1, that is our two permanent members. Now, those members, in terms of 2A Roman 1, one of them must perform their functions in terms of this act, and then in Roman 2, the other member, in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. We have decided to make an additional proposal, Chair, and that you'll find under paragraph B, apart from the requirement that the two permanent members must be appointed respectively to perform functions in terms of the Act and the Bahia respectively, we propose that the members referred to in 36D2 must exercise their powers and perform their duties and functions either in terms of this Act or the Promotion of Access to Information Act or both. And then in sub C, we deal with the accountability of those members to the extent that in terms of performing their duties, they are accountable to the chairperson.
Where did we put that the regulator is accountable to Parliament? We did put it in somewhere, I hope. Because what the only thing that reads strangely to me, I mean, it is good that we say that the regulators, the chairperson is the boss. But in B, in 38B, it reads strangely to me that he is accountable to the regulator. The rest can be accountable to him, it's okay. But how is he accountable to the regulator? He leads it. And the whole must be accountable to us.
Chief, the regulator is, of course, an independent body subject to the Constitution and must perform their functions in terms of this Act. Is a juristic person, so the in other words, all the members, chairperson included, as a juristic person, is accountable to Parliament. I'm just trying to quickly get our provision, which, yeah. We do not have a provision.
Can it go in the 35D and it is to the National Assembly? Not Parliament, but it would be the same as the public. It's not accountability.
Chair, I just wanted to mention that, strictly speaking, it is there. It's where you get your audit reports and all those type of stuff, but it's not expressed. Thank you, Chair. The proposed amendments are self-explanatory. I don't think we need to bore you with details here. 40 is our conflict of
take into account it.
Take into account all of it, maybe you can just put it. Unfortunately, first language,
Mr. Chairman, I just respond there. We're always being criticized that we do not write our legislation in plain language. Let me check. Clause 40.
Say, Mario, is it one you have on the
mind? Yeah, no, just one with confinement. Okay. All right, 40.
Conflict of interest provision, Mr. Chair. Strictly speaking, if a member has, or a member of the staff has a conflict of interest insofar as their duties are concerned, they are obliged to divulge that information where the regulator has its meetings, but it's not an all-out requirement to the extent that a decision may be made that the relevant interest may be of a frivolous nature, and then that member or member of the staff may continue with the duties. In sub 1, Chair, I would just like to point out something to you, and that is the question, if we read, if any member of the regulator or member of the staff of the regulator has a material interest in any matter which could conflict with the proper performance of his or her duties in terms of this Act. Strictly speaking, and depending on what the final decision of the committee will be, but I mean we've already passed that point, we should actually refer to PAHIA as well. Or that is the question.
Yes, it would be
PAHIA. Sorry, Chair, that was my mistake. Don't know whether I need to bore you with the detail again, Chair. It's a question of me reading it. Clause 41. Nothing special there. Except, of course, Mr. Chair, this is also a provision which caused some discomfort in the technical committee in the past, and I think the question is whether this provision should footnote 49, decision regarding disqualification of public servants for appointment as members, the regulator is still pending. It has recently proposed that reference to the Public Service Act should be deleted.
Opinion. So obviously if none of them are allowed to be, then yes, it would be, it should be deleted, but we haven't resolved that. You know, it's a different position on the technical.
Well, is the compromise between us then possibly that you can second public servants for the purposes of
the
staff?
Not the staff.
Oh, no.
So you did?
Agreed that they have to resign upon appointment.
No, we don't agree. That's why I'm saying that public servants issue is still an option.
We thought we did agree. I thought the only difference. That's why I raised the previous one the way I did.
My worry is the part-time issue. Part-time members of the regulator. They're going to be regulating the private sector. If you're a part-time member of the regulator, because the regulator is going to be primarily, at least as far as particular information involved in regulating the private sector, why should you be able to be a member of, employed by PricewaterhouseCoopers, and the person who lost the personal information, that you cannot allow to be a member of the public service? It's not just the state,
but you've got a bond from the money, you've got a bond from the job.
Mr. Chair, while the culinary feast is being presented to the committee, may I just ask, and I think I'm really missing the point on the debate, please excuse me, but what 41 says is if you're not subject to the provisions of the Public Service Act, in other words, you're not a public servant, you are eligible for appointment as a member of the regulator. All that 41 says, that if you're not subject to the provisions, so all four of them will not be subject to the provisions of the Public Service Act. So that means that you will be entitled to the remuneration allowances, etc., etc. So it's... Yeah. Well...
I mean, we're not agreed that the part-time members may remain, maybe public service. That's not what we agreed on. And also, you know, what happens with judges and magistrates? You know, where a judge or a magistrate is appointed to a body, they don't get paid. They do get the travel allowance and things like that. But you're no, I'm talking about your last the judge doesn't get paid for being, I think, last the magistrate commission people don't get paid for being on the magistrate commission being the magistrate.
All right.
You see, that's where we must be careful, because we've got an enforcement committee now, and we have our judges. Strictly speaking, we're only referring here to those four, five members,
yeah,
and not the members of the enforcement committee.
Yeah.
So they must be drawn in here,
yeah,
as well.
We're going a bit round in circles. We have not taken, and I've respected other people's, other members of the committee's rights to put in options. We have not resolved the members of the regulator may not be public service. But not resolved it relates specifically to part time and the conviction to some extent that because the regulator is dealing a lot in the private sector, that it's fine to be employed from the private sector, but not in the public sector. So in this respect, we have two options on the issue of public service. If you have a public servant as a member of the regulator, then the way Section 41 is worded is necessary.
You can't have a member of the public servant as a member of the regulator.
Can you respect the different positions? Because, as I said, if the regulator... I mean, yeah, we're going round in a circle. I respect other positions.
Can
we just leave it as that?
Can I ask you two questions?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to understand where you come from. I don't have a specific view. Why do you want part-time members?
Well, we've
already, or why do you want to make allowance for it?
We've already provided for the fact that they, you know, we've dealt with that question. We have increased the number of full-time members. I think it was only the chair who was full-time before. We still have to, in order to take a final decision on that, look at the costing implications of the additions that we're
making. So you want to address the just-in-case approach that you want to keep open. I mean, why do you want to have part-time members? What is your rationale?
Well, it's basically that we may not be able to afford full-time members.
Okay. You see, because my concern is that I accept your analogy, but the fact is that the private sector is not an entity as the state is. So you might have a conflict in respect of one thing, but not to the entire system of the private sector. the state is one entity which responds to one system of power with one guy at the top, where the needs of one department are carried through a conveyor belt of cabinet, etc., into the guy at the other end. So it's very easy for one department to get hold of the other civil servant that serves there. It is one entity. So I think that there is a differentiation between being compromised within the private sector and being compromised within the public sector.
We have, in this technical committee, we are not reaching consensus on issues. We are looking, yes, and it would be nice if we could have thrown out a whole lot of your options. So can we keep this in as an option, please? Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Well, no, Dean, please sit down, and we will, when we end, we go up to the end of the section, we will then go to the
end. The Chair, I just wanted to announce the end of the section.
You still got to deal with the staff?
Chair. Chair, once again, nothing new or special there. A provision which the committee already had a look at once or twice. I'm just scanning quickly to see whether there's anything that we need to highlight. I don't see.
And what I'm going to offer you there is to say, don't make it independent body and then allow the convent from the state.
But I was going to make a gesture there and say to you, for the purposes of, you know, starting the new regulator up, which we could phrase appropriately pompously, but I mean, how can you second public servants into an independent body? Yeah, something like that.
Well, this is a difference of opinion.
This is a terribly technical bill. So I could see value in some of the people involved in this process going there at the beginning just to shape the mindset, explain what it's all about, and take. Because, I mean, you're not going to find out there a person qualified for the job. There isn't a job description. You don't get an engineer, you put him in charge of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, because it's nuclear engineer and fits. This is a new job. So having some of the people going from here to there for the first 2 years could make sense. But I do agree with Dean, it should be subjected to a sunset provision.
Yeah, I know your views. Can we reflect the two options, please? Thank you.
The same thing was done with the predecessor of ICASA, the IBA and the SATRA. And people like Mr. Ken Herold, who was an engineer, went across to help. But they weren't seconded. They were appointed by the new independent regulators or authorities, as the case may be.
Chair, we can only pray for the civil servant who seconded to start up this. It's going to be a terrible job.
Accommodate you by saying do it temporarily.
Okay, can we carry on?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Chair. The powers and duties of the functions of the CEO Chair. He is the, or she is the head of the administration and the accounting officer of the regulator. May appoint a senior member of staff as acting chief executive officer to perform the functions of CEO in his or her absence. He is responsible for the management of the affairs and operations of the regulator.
Sorry, what happens if they start it? What happens if they pass away to appoint
the
acting CEO?
Yeah, the CEOs appoint their own acting CEOs. You've got an authority, a regulator, a board there. It's their job.
You
Look, it's not unusual in the, well, it's not unusual in the public service. Whenever your director general, any staff member is going away from week to week to day, they point acting. So that kind of acting, I mean, that's what it provides for us.
It sets a time period on it, and I've never seen that before.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
It would be in his or her temporary absence or absence. Yeah, I don't know. Mine is more in case that they have died or they have, yeah, what so the regulator appoints.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I found the section to find it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So shall we leave it at that at this stage?
Payment consistent with the public sector is not, we've said it before, that's in 42.4. It's not going to draw you the expertise you need.
Yes, that's footnoted to you. That's something we need to keep. Committees of the Regulator Chair, it's also a provision which were, we received previously instructions on, and the committee already had an opportunity to look at that. Now we have two new provisions, the establishment of an enforcement committee and then the functions of the enforcement committee. Now, 45.1 determines that the regulator must establish an enforcement committee which must consist of at least one member of the regulator and such other persons appointed by the regulator as referred to in section 42.5 for the period determined by the regulator. And then sub 2, the chairperson of the enforcement committee must be a judge of the High Court of South Africa, whether in active service or not, an advocate or attorney with at least 10 years appropriate experience, or a magistrate with at least 10 years appropriate experience, whether in active service or not. The chairperson of the enforcement committee must manage the work of and preside at hearings of the enforcement committee. 4A, a member referred to in sub 1A, may not participate in any proceedings of the regulator in terms of which a decision is taken with regard to a finding or a recommendation of the enforcement committee as referred to in section 46. B, the person referred to in subsection 1B must be a fit and proper person and must comply with the criteria referred to in section 36.1F for appointment as a member of the regulator.
Yeah, I think that's cool, but I didn't understand the reference in B to 42.5. I couldn't find the appropriate. Such other persons appointed as referred to in 42.5. You see, that doesn't seem to me to be the right reference.
My apologies. I will have a look at that again, and I will just correct the situation for us. I remember looking at this recently, but I will address that for us. While we're with that paragraph, I would just like to raise the question whether the technical committee feels that the number of members of the enforcement committee should be limited. A proposal, for example, I mean, the question is really, should this enforcement committee be very large? Couldn't we possibly introduce a requirement that it only consists of 3 members, including the chairperson? At this stage, it's open-ended, I think.
Investigation is, in fact, you raised the question later on, but I do think some investigation is also going to occur under their remit. And now, that doesn't mean the committee itself has to be giant, unless we... It's a little unpredictable how often... We could say that they have to sit in panels of 3 or whatever. But I think, but the ICASA CCC, the triple complaints and compliance committee is what, it's only 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I think that's enough.
So the ICASA Act specifies a maximum.
Remember you had that provision for us to look at last time, didn't you? One of your studies.
I mean, think to do the ICASA or how that is to do the ICASA specify maximum.
They have written the record of the not more than 7 members, one of whom must be counted.
ICASA, complaints and compliance. The authority must establish a complaints and compliance committee consists of not more than 7, one of whom is counsellor. Chair must be a judge, advocate or magistrate. Committee must manage the work of preside. Fit and proper, suitable qualifications, blah blah blah. Investigate and hear and make a finding. All matters referred.
How are they in terms of ICASA, how are they paid? Who determines how they're paid?
I have absolutely no idea, but ICASA would.
But there's no provision for that here.
Chair, that's why I said we should remind ourselves, especially the example of the Public Service Act provision, that we must make provision for them.
An independent body which appoints its own staff, then pitches for its budget, either directly to Treasury or through its relevant Assembly Committee, and it works out its staffing requirements. It's not the Public Service. They have their own staff establishments.
Yes, but the point I'm making is at the moment there's no provision for any payment, for anyone to determine the payment. Obviously the regulator would decide on the payment, but there needs to be a provision to that effect in the bill. You provide for payment remuneration of staff in the staff section, the remuneration of members of the regulator, but you don't provide for any payment for staff. So that needs to be provided for. As far as the number, I mean, I don't know whether my worry with the, it's something I was going to raise at the end, is that we need to know the additional responsibilities that we're putting on the regulator. We need to know how much it's going to cost. So we're not legislating ideally and then finding that it won't work because it isn't the money. So we need to know how much you're going to need to do something for the full committee on the cost increase that we are adding here. I'm because we don't quite know how it's going to work, I'm personally reluctant to fix a maximum. I mean, the regulator has its budget. They can see how much they can afford. So I mean, 7 was ICASA, which maybe had more functions set out. There may be a need for panels, but I really am quite reluctant to specify a maximum on the basis that the budgetary constraints will limit them anyway. They won't be able to go wild unless some persons in other bodies get onto this regulator. No, you don't want to know. Okay.
We'll have a look at that.
So basically what we're saying is please make some kind of provision for payment of members of regulator, of the members of the regulator, and then what do you do with the judge and the magistrate if they're there, because they're not going to get paid, presumably. Is that not a requirement of in some other law?
Yeah, we'll have to check that for you. It's the Public Office Bearers Act. But a similar provision can be drafted to ensure.
If every judge and
magistrate knows that in terms of the Public Office Bearers Act that they do not get paid for anything else, then you don't need to put it in here. It would only be... So I don't know if the LASA Act or the Legal Aid Act says that the chairperson will not get paid for what they do. I don't know if the Magistrates Commission Act says that members of the commission who are...
Judicial Services Amendment Act. Sounds wrong, but I think it's in there. It's the provision that says the only other income, you know, they're paid for life, only other income they may get whatsoever is for honorariums in respect of legal books. It really is very restrictive, or lecturing.
Okay, if the judges and magistrates are covered, then
you would
fine,
think it would be in judges' remuneration and blah, 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 but I think it's in JSC.
But then just check, because, you know, who's going to pay this, the advocate or attorney with 10 years' service who probably doesn't come cheap.
So all you've got to do really on the enforcement committee is make some provision for some
Yes, Chair.
And you would probably then include A and C. Are you having an service and other people in the race?
No.
Are they also covered? So if they're already covered by judicial services and judicial officers or whatever, then you
But
I think the issue Dean is state work.
This is from the public purse, so the idea is that they don't get paid twice. So if they go and serve on some other panel that's private, then maybe they can, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Functions of the Enforcement Committee, Chair. I think those provisions are self-explanatory. It's a question of advising the regulator with regard to complaints received in terms of the Act and AHIA, and then also possibly a bit wider by making certain recommendations regarding the performance of the functions. I would just like to highlight footnote 56 as well. You will recall that we semi-copied this from ICASA, but ICASA also deals with the procedure of the Enforcement Committee and then findings by the Enforcement Committee and then the decision following those findings by the regulator. Those provisions have been copied in that annexure, that document that we handed out previously. So that is something that we still need to, or the committee still need to guide us on. But at this stage, we've got the Enforcement Committee and their function, which will of course assist is that the chairperson will manage the work of and preside at hearings of the Enforcement Committee. That is now 45(3). So to a certain extent, we do have a fairly flexible Enforcement Committee. Thank you, Chair. The next page 33, clause 47. Thank you, Chair. Funds, clause 48. At this stage, the funds of the regulator will then consist of sums of money appropriated by Parliament annually. And then also in B.
Should that not be fees as may be? B is section 109 is a sunrise.
Before you get there, can we take a look at 75(1) of the Constitution? Okay, I'm quoting by memory. It says that everything must go in the National Revenue Fund except under extraordinary circumstances. Did I quote the commandment? Bad with numbers. I think it's 75(1).
213.
Huh?
213.
That's covered in the bank.
All money received by national government must be paid, except money reasonably excluded by national parliament.
Reasonably. It was only reasonably.
No.
It was only
sorry.
Reasonably.
Can I
No, that's more like it.
Yeah.
That's the way I remember it. The other day you were so adamant.
This month, sorry, where are you going?
I'm just going to heaven.
It's an incentive. Yeah. When we get to the end of part A. Okay. Look, I mean, it's 48B is covered by that section of the Constitution. But
you made this back off an argument
the other
day.
Maybe just lies to indicate that
we're
not necessarily going to be right. Okay?
Okay, but can we decide why we are not putting this money in the National Revenue Fund?
Because we want it into the regulator
to make money. Yeah, I understand this, Mr. Chairman, but this is the, you know, it's the issue of whether you should reward caps on the amount of traffic tickets they issue. I mean, here there is somebody who needs to be independent from his own greed. We have a system in which they decide the extent to which this act applies and how far to cast the net. They should do so in the public interest, not in the private interest. We were together in England, where the English regulator and half just told us, well, we throw the net much wider when we need to collect more money. When we're running out of money, we bring more people into the scope of application.
No, it is about the fine. It is about the fees prescribed by the minister. So they administer the fees. They're
yeah.
Not the fine. It's not the tax.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but I understand. But the fact is that they determine who should apply, who this fee should apply to. And they have the power to cast the net as wide as they wish it to be in terms of the actual coverage of this bill. Because we all agree that this bill has got universal application. We all agree that it will not apply, hopefully, to you and I, even though the letter should. And they will determine the extent to which. I think that having a mechanism by virtue of which they keep their own money will create an enormous incentive to make decisions in their own interest rather than the public interest.
As a general rule, Chad, there's merit in that argument, but if it's a different kind of money, we have agreed that entities that process information have to notify the regulator that they are processing. You and I started off on a different position about notification. I have become utterly persuaded they must now notify. They are under a statutory obligation to do so. And so there can be nothing wrong in the regulator benefiting from such fees as in due course may be prescribed. It is our intention as the legislator that everybody who processes must notify. So the more the regulator gets people to notify, the better. It simply complies with what will be the law. It's not as if you are arbitrarily exercising some of your powers. There are cases in which it could become undesirable. This is not one of them.
Can you put a footnote if Dr. Kumbasini wants it? Doesn't like it. That's for 48.1b. Carry on.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I would just like to flag the issue with regard to your proposal of including the words as may be. We'll get to 109. There's a difference.
The idea with that is that my fear is the way to win with the loan is that the fees will be prescribed and they won't be necessarily.
Thank you, Chief.
49.
Yes, Chief. And that brings us to clause 50, except at the top of page 34, the option is also to delete the protection of the regulator.
I'm happy to
withdraw on footnote 59, option to delete clause 42.
Are you happy to withdraw?
No, I want to have two statements that you would not mind because I'm not moving fast enough. focusing my attention, if I can bring it back, and then I will go back to 249. I had a problem with this 49, and I've given some contrary language, which I don't see reflected here.
The civil or criminal liability of staff?
Yes.
The only question is whether you...
My difficulty at the time, you remember, Mr. Chairman, is that if you do it in good faith, you're off the hook. No matter how dumb, no matter how negligent, no matter how irresponsible you may be. And this, I don't think it's one how one can cast the relationship between state and citizen.
Or independent body.
Independent, but still part of the state. So, I mean, it's good faith is not good enough for me. So, I don't see why we need... My first option was delete this. My second option, let's only exempt negligence, but not gross negligence, and surely... No, well, you cannot have malice and good faith at the same time, but...
So
you want to skip the option? I'm going to draw 59 options proposed by the committee. Then. 52.
Yes.
50. I remember correctly, this is also a provision which have been dealt with by the committee previously. I'm just scanning quickly to see whether we have inserted anything new. We do have our footnotes. Maybe here and there language as proposed by the committee previously. Oh yes, maybe I could just highlight subclause 3, Mr. Chair, where we now make full use of the definition of information matching programs. And that provision comes from another provision which has been included here at the request of the committee. 44.3, Chair, footnote 64. So you will find it duplicated in sub 3, except for we realize that the introductory part we refer to nothing else than information matching programs. So we just sort of modified the language for you a bit. Then 44, 45 deleted as a result of the fact that they've been inserted in other
just
provisions.
One issue that I've got is that should clause 50 be not move to after 35. So you have the establishment of the regulator, then you say what the powers and functions are. So this makes more sense. And then you go into detail of who's appointed and how much they're paid and who determines all that kind of stuff.
Mr. Chair, we can certainly do that for you, but we will appreciate if we could do that with all these provisions. At the previous meeting, the Chair said that we will get to the order of the clauses at a later stage, but that is something that must receive attention.
Go in terms of the reordering, because as I said, for me it makes sense you establish the regulator, you say it's part of the function, and then you look the order of the regulator.
We're then on 451, and just be given that, which is straightforward. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
think maybe I apologize in advance to Ms. Smuts, but clause 51, and it's just a question that was raised. I would like to discuss it with my esteemed colleague as well, but I wonder whether we shouldn't clarify this. Any member of the regulator, member of the staff of the regulator, or person acting on behalf of. So in other words, just to be on the safe side, insert the words members of the staff of the regulator there as well.
But now, if you left it as it was, any person acting on behalf, that includes the member, includes the staff. Is this amendment that you want actually really helping?
Yeah.
Are we not better off with any person acting on behalf of one of the directions of the regulator?
We'll delete then the proposed insertion. Just go back to the original wording.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Information protection officers is pretty straightforward. I thought it was also a good breakdown. Well, let's put you in D.
Excuse me. I think you can maybe start eating and walking around, but I just wanted one thing, Hank, but I just need clarification on with regards to the information officer. And I'll refer back to that where in section, the current section 53, where in the mayor prescribed in section 17. Because that section 17 in PAYA only refers to public bodies. It doesn't refer to private bodies. And also the fact that it's not amended in this. Because it says there, with the necessary changes, if we look at 53, each public and private body must make provision in the manner prescribed in section 17 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act with the necessary changes.
Mr. Chair, just on a technical point, I only receive questions through the chair. Mitatis mitandis, I think, is the answer. But we'll check that. We'll check that to make sure. But I don't think it's a problem.
Even if section 17 relates to public bodies, it applies to private bodies where each public and private body must make provision with the necessary changes. So I don't know.
If you actually go and read by itself, section 17, it only speaks to public bodies.
Yes,
so it might create.
No, because it says each public and private body make provision in the manner prescribed in section 17 with the necessary changes. So I would feel with the necessary changes don't cover private bodies.
You read them in mitatis mitandis, yes. But we'll make sure.
Okay. Can we stop 10 minutes, 10 to 4? That's enough time for people to take nicotine and I don't think we'll both do nicotine as we do for them, right? I'm going to go to the next one.
Thank you.
Okay, we're starting again. Does Henk had an issue on the judge and the magistrate on the enforcement committee?
Yes, Chair, thank you. Chair, I was just concerned that we copy these provisions from existing legislation, but we should never stop looking at them critically. And the question that arose was whether it is appropriate, if we look at the provisions of 45, whether it is appropriate for the regulator to simply appoint a judge of the High Court as chairperson of this enforcement committee without at least consulting with the JP or the minister, I suppose, judge president, most appropriately. So
I think provide for that, I think both the JP and the, well, it would be the Chief Justice, really, and the minister, and then the same with the magistrates. I mean, the Chief Justice is the head of the judiciary, so... but somebody...
So both the Chief Justice
and the Minister, Chair.
Both Chief Justice and the Minister, and then I don't know what you do for a magistrate. I mean, presumably somebody, same rules apply, somebody
Okay, the Minister, because the Minister appoints them. Thank you, Chair. Right, Chair, thank you. Then we are now at chapter 6, page 37, clause 54. Once again, Chair, straightforward and primarily consequential amendments in 54, the new 54, the new 55. We do not have anything there. Chair, I just wanted to mention to you that 54.1, and I'm just mentioning that because while we broke, I just had a quick read through again. I'm just concerned about the format of subclause 1. And we'll just check that for you and report back at the next meeting. If necessary, we will change the format. But something just... Yes. I think it's purely format-wise. I think the very last few words, if such processing is subject to prior investigation, must be outdated. But we'll check that format and come back to you on that one. Clause 55, nothing to report. 56, nothing to report. 57, nothing to report. And then under 58, the option that we've included there is an attempt to redraft subclause 2 to try and clarify the meaning of subclause 2.
It's always preferable to handle offences within the law rather than leaving them to regulations.
Chair, we do not feel very strongly about the option, but my concern is that if you read 2, it is a declaration of an offence or creation of an offence even before you have the relevant notification regulations. What subclause 2 says there is all the notification regulations that you have will be met with criminal sanction if they're not complied with. Now, it might be that you would only want to have 5 of your 10 notification regulations, if they are contravened, then being met with a criminal sanction. I feel uncomfortable with a provision like that, but if the committee feels, and possibly we can request CISA to maybe have a look at that. I'm just concerned about, you know, you get, this is a priori creation of a crime before you have the definitional elements.
Okay, can we leave it as an option for now?
I'm trying to go through my notes. I have made, in respect of this provision, time and again, the proposal that it should be the other way around. And I don't want to sell the merits of my proposal again, but I just want to register, and perhaps having it registered, where the, instead of having a general duty to notify as set out in 54, and then exemptions given by the regulator, that it would work the other way around, that the regulator would identify through codes the areas to which the duty to notify would apply. I know that that doesn't meet favor with you too, but I would like nonetheless to...
Can it be a footnote?
Am I being clear?
You don't have to do wording, but you just indicate Dr. Albertini's preference. Okay.
Oh, can I just write that footnote and
Leave
it? Okay.
Well, subject to us moving there.
Yes.
You know when you write things.
So terrified by other views.
59?
Thank you, Chair. 59. Not much there. We were just requested at the previous meeting to redraft, to clarify the position there. The issue of unique identifiers. And sub 3, Chair, that's merely a technical recommendation. The relevant part only consists of those two sections. It would be technically more appropriate just to refer to the sections. Under 60, we've got consequential amendments apart from subclause 6, where the wording is proposed to be inserted just for clarity purposes. Does not change the meaning of that subclause. And then the request was also to introduce an offence here, which deals with a failure to notify. You have the proposed insertion there now. Chapter 7, Codes of Conduct. Clause 62 is merely consequential, Mr. Chair. 63, I think the committee has already had a look at this as well. There's nothing new, Mr. Chair. 64.
Sorry, just what is the calling? I know what it means in idiomatic English, but is it legal? On our copy, 41, 63.2, just above 63.2, in respect of such class, bodies, or any such industry, profession, or calling. And my question is, what is the meaning of calling? You get called to the priesthood. What do you mean by calling?
A vocation.
I think it might be something similar to...
It was in the Act, calling with the Act that you represent.
Vocation.
Or calling is defined in the code. Okay, no,
that's... Vocation. Part of the Latin.
Your bell.
Do we need
it
now?
What do you mean by calling?
I think the idea was that it can be any sort of group that can, any sort of group that can motivate themselves.
Like NGOs.
No, it's a work group. Is what's meant. Why don't you have vocation?
in addition to calling too.
I mean, to my mind, you get called to calling for peace, or to be a nurse or a teacher. But is that legally definable?
I wouldn't mind if it's if you use the word vocation.
Can you have a look at it? I mean, it doesn't. I mean, think about it. But see if you can have vocation. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Or 64, notification availability and commencement of the code. There's nothing to report there, Chair. Those proposed amendments are merely technical in nature and consequential under sub 2. Sub 2 provides that the code of conduct issued under section 62 comes into force on the 28th day after the date of its notification in the Gazette, or on such later date as may be specified in the code, and is binding on every class or classes of body, industry, profession or calling referred to therein. I don't know whether the committee would like to possibly just consider the possibility of including the option that the code may be may come into operation or into force sooner than the specified 28 days.
I think that is a protection. After all, we're dealing here with laws adopted by an independent agency. If anyone is to rush to court, at least has got 28 days to do so.
Thank you, Chair. 65, consequential in nature, Mr. Chair, and then we just proposed on sub 3, footnote 74, that it may be appropriate in view of the fact that the regulator may amend or revoke a code, that one should provide for pending matters. That is also something that we've discussed previously. 66, not much to...
I mean, do we want to have this rule? I mean, if you look at legislation, when we revoke a piece of legislation, we can effectively revoke it, as we say, ex tunc or ex nunc. We can revoke it as if it never existed. We can repeal it as if it never existed. Or we can repeal it effective this time, so that whatever transactions took place while the old law was in place are still regulated by the old law. And I think that discretion is very important. I would substitute section 3, I mean subsection 3 with language to the extent that when repealing a code, or revoking, if you wish to use the word revoking, the regulator may decide whether or not the new code will apply to pending matters.
No, you can't be subject to something that wasn't in existence when you...
If it is better, yes.
Well, or if it's worse. I mean, there's different... I think that the issue is the law applies as it happened, as it was when it happened.
Well, for instance, in criminal law, that's never the case. When you decriminalize something, it's always retroactive. I mean, say that you lower a standard.
Yeah, we're dealing with civil matters here. It's not criminal.
Say that you lower a standard.
And the advantage of the individual.
And somebody was not in compliance with the old standard, but would be in compliance with the new standard. And these are criminal matters. I mean, the code is a parameter of criminal action. They don't respect the code, they commit an offense.
you must just take into consideration, Chair, in a civil matter where something is to the advantage of one party, it may very well be to the disadvantage of another party. You've got the responsible party on the one side and the data subject on the other. Something is amended to the advantage of one, it will most probably be to the disadvantage of the other. So the question is, shouldn't it be the law as it was then? That should
be
applied.
Would it not be better just to leave it out? And then they can argue it, if the code has been changed, they can argue it. I mean, normally it would be the law as it exists at the time, so the code as it was at the time. But if it is the case where there's an improvement for everybody, you put in must, and if you don't have must, then it becomes meaningless. But then they can't adjudicate the benefit of the change. Whereas if you leave it out, they can decide on a case-by-case basis how they deal with it.
Yeah, we can certainly do that as a matter of interest. We'll just have a look and see whether the Interpretation Act won't cover that position
okay.
then in the
event. Check on that. By the way, I just looked up calling in the... nobody's responded yet. On the dictionary, on the internet, and it is they describe it as vocation or profession. So you've already got profession, so I think vocation then makes sense instead of calling. So you're going to look at three, as to whether it is in fact necessary and whether it's not covered by the Interpretation Act.
We'll do that, Chief. Thank you very much.
But don't change it to a may, because then it becomes meaningless. So it's either there as must, because of a reason, or it's gone.
Okay. Thank you very much. Guidelines, clause 66, nothing to report. Clause 67, nothing to report. 68, consequential amendment. 69. Not much to report, Chair. It's merely for purposes of clarification and consequential amendments. Clause 70. Not much to report, consequential amendment, except to indicate, Chair, that if a... we just needed to insert a reference to section 62. The reference to the section fell out. And then if I may take you back, Chair, just allow me a second, please. And thanks for Ananda for reminding me. We've been struggling, and if I may, I just need to take you back to 69. We are, of course, now dealing with the complaints or the codes procedure, and the question is under sub 3. Responsible. We've proposed that we should insert the words responsible party or a data subject who is aggrieved by a determination. The question arose between the two of us whether originally it was restricted to a data subject, is the only party who may complain, but then the question arose, but shouldn't the responsible party also be allowed? Have we already discussed this?
No, we haven't.
If the data subject complain because they don't like the ruling, why can't the responsible party?
Yes, Chair, and that is still our general feeling. The only factor that one might want to mention to the advantage of the committee is that we keep in mind that the responsible parties were all involved.
They were involved in drawing up the code. Now this is the adjudication of the dispute in terms of the code, and they may not. The result may not be there.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, Chair, Chapter 8.
Just before that, what is the effect of 70? You breach the code, so it's deemed to be a breach of the conditions. So what?
means that you can submit a complaint to the regulator or institute a civil action.
Can you specify that? Because, I mean, the fact that it's in breach of the of principles or what the conditions, what effect does that have?
It's specified later on, where you deal with the civil claims. Thank you, Jay. Unsolicited electronic communications. Not much to report there, except maybe to point out that this was a point of debate recently, which the committee also took note of, especially sub 2. I don't know whether the chair would like to raise anything in that regard. And then it's just consequential amendments, renumbering. 72, nothing, chair. And then 73, also an attempt to just clarify the ambit of sub 1. Transborder information flows, 74 has also been discussed previously by the committee. I don't know whether the chair would want us to. Enforcement, 75. Consequential amendments, chair, we will just in the final instance before we present our final version just check our cross references again. Complaints. Consequential amendments in an attempt to clarify the ambit of sub 1 and sub 2. 77, not much to report.
Just on 77 now, why, you've got at the back, on page 73, page 69, I think my pages are different to yours, where you've got the fronts and my options, which seem to just vary as to whether it is a recommendation notice or an enforcement notice. Why are you putting it there, not in here?
Because those are proposed amendments to Bahia.
Oh, is that
the
Bahia? Okay.
Yes, chair.
Okay.
Right. Investigation. 73 and 74 have been combined into the new 78. Don't think there's much to discuss the chair. 79, consequential amendment, only one in sub 1. 80.
I just want to does it anywhere say that whoever is subject to enforce to investigation enforcement action has the right to be informed of it, and interact with the regulator through counsel? Is that covered?
Not necessarily.
Counsel isn't the notifying
citizen. As soon as, Chair, can, I suppose we'll, I just need to search for it. I don't know it by heart, but the provisions are there. No, we'll certainly get back to
The right of having an interaction through counsel. And you see, it's not unless what the right is spelled out, one doesn't have it. This is an unusual animal. It's investigating criminal conduct, and all the guarantees that are in the law. When the police investigates criminal conduct, might not necessarily be here. I mean, there is a process, and I know that it will be formally charged at a later stage, and I know that at the later stage, those guarantees will kick in. But we need to apply our mind whether or not it should not some of those guarantees should not be brought back brought forward within the process and taken into account at this stage.
Thank you, Jim. We'll report back on that. Clause 81, nothing. Clause 82, consequential amendment. Clause 83.
On this, I don't know where this fits in, but the issue of enforcement.
81. I just found
81.
81. Sorry about that.
You
guys are
found 81.
Responsible party to the business schedule arrives from the result of the contract. Right to the responsible party.
But no, my concern is we're establishing this enforcement policy. In the section dealing with complaints, that's where they come in. Enforcement committee must consider and hear appropriate to make a finding on all matters referred to by the regulator in terms of these acts. Now, shouldn't there be references to the enforcement committee in this section?
Yes, I think that is the decision that needs to be taken, because we've only included, insofar as the enforcement committee is concerned, the establishment and functions. But we haven't really referred to, like they do in Newcastle, to the procedure or the findings or the decision or whatever. So at the moment, it's flexible and it's in the hands of the regulator. So the Act only says, you know, you make your complaint to the regulator. How it happens within the regulator, we haven't... describe that.
The
so.
78 that the regulator, I think that's the right place, that the regulator may that the regulator may refer the matter to the enforcement committee. I mean, just a simple line. There doesn't have to be an elaborate procedure. It's basically
just
flexible. But more just no linkage between dealing with complaints and the enforcement committee. You've given them, when you created them, you've given them the power to hear matters referred to it. But you're not saying in this section on complaints that the regulator may refer matters to it.
And obviously in our own minds, whether there are two kinds of investigation, the kind that might be done outside the enforcement committee and the kind that the enforcement committee might undertake itself. You yourselves have put question marks next to various investigation provisions, and I'm not sure we're clear in our minds. Remember, we looked at that court case and said that Concord has said it is okay to do inquisitorial stuff and investigative stuff inside one body. It's all right legally. But we haven't clearly said that. And I think you were waiting the final decisions on FIA as well before you did the last two or three clauses, not so, for the Enforcement Committee. I think Prunier might have good ideas, since you were quite keen on... We're not having a tribunal in the end, but you were keen on further bodies, so we got the Enforcement Committee. So you might be useful to us, yeah.
Well, I think as long as you know, like you have somebody that's watching the policeman, that was my main concern from the beginning, and maybe the initial idea of having a tribunal, and also to alleviate the mechanism of every time going to court in order to get like a sort of an enforcement against the party, because our courts as they stand at the moment is already very backlogged. And if you then sit and deal with situations where you actually have to go to court every time there's a complaint, and you need to, you know, like take it all the way through. That was just my initial concern. Exactly. I know, like, for instance, in the UK, and I know that's not your preferred sort of structure, but... Yeah. The thing is, you know, like they started initially having the regulator fulfilling the role of an ombudsman, and only later on that of a policeman. So the policeman activity is only coming through now in the way of fines, etc. But I think the way it's now with the enforcement sort of like body that we're building into it, you know, that might definitely, you know, like take away that load that we'll have in our courts. As long as there is just something else than every time, because otherwise I might just well go to court to kick the regulator and go by myself.
But on 78, on receiving the complaint, the regulator may A, investigate the complaint, or B, decide not to do anything. Shouldn't there be a new B, investigate the complaint, refer to the enforcement committee, or C, decide to do nothing?
Yeah.
Clause 78, it is, I think the heading is investigation by regulator, still remains that heading. Well, it's actually not investigate, it's actually action on receipt of complaint, that should be the heading. And it's on receiving the complaint, the regulator may, one, investigate, two, refer the matter to the enforcement committee, or C, decide in accordance with 79 not to take any action.
That's where we were. Under 83, we've got the option proposed by Dr. Ambrosini. merely a consequential amendment or for purposes of clarity under sub 2.
I'm sorry, Dr. Ambrosini, you still want this invitation?
Well,
it's basically a little bit toothless.
Okay.
84 we've highlighted. 85, consequential amendments, Mr. Chair. Section, clause 86, same. That's just a renumbering, as well as clauses 87 and 88.
Let's go with 88 because that's where there was
the question around whether it's in or not. You're recommending that it be retained. My view is yes, it makes sense specifying, but if we are retaining it, we just need to then go back to the definition. Do we, just to the committee, clause 88, you've seen the footnote 84, is everybody happy that this clause of communication between, of the exemption for communication between legal advisor and client remains? You've read the footnote 84, it's quite long. I mean, it will be the footnote. Sorry, no. I'm. Their recommendation is to retain the clause because it extends a privilege. Because the common law is limited to litigation.
I thought we'd agreed.
No, Dean was thinking we'd agreed to delete it.
The other way.
But having read the footnote, I can't remember what we agreed, but having read the footnote, I think it's useful having it, because my worry is the common law seems a bit limited. Okay. Then can we quickly go back to page 9. So you can take out the footnote then. And the definition of professional legal advisor, they've got a means a legal practitioner or a person whose occupation involves the giving of legal advice. That was instead of legally qualified person, whether in private practice or not, who lawfully provides a client at his or her own request with independent, confidential legal advice. My worry with your change is occupation. That you could be a legal advisor whose occupation is not. They do other things, but on the side you give the odd legal opinion, which you charge for, and that should be exempt. So I don't know. I was happier, I think, with the original definition. But you wanted to speak more, Henk Wananda, on why you wanted that change.
Well, the new one is broader.
Well,
and you're saying you want.
Well,
you see,
what purpose, if we're looking at the notion of privilege,
let me refer just for a sake to the American experience, because there it's more concretized. The privilege is for the benefit of the client. Even if the person who is giving the legal advice is not a lawyer, but purport to be a lawyer, and told the client that he's a lawyer, the privilege exists. Because the situation is that the client will act in a certain manner vis-à-vis somebody who believes to be the lawyer, and within a relationship in which he receives legal advice, which may expose him. So, if we're looking for purposes of Section 88, that legal definition does the job better than the old one.
No, we've gone wider than the common law.
Yes.
Okay. And because of that, I would not want to widen. I have a problem with okay, a legal practitioner is generally clear. Well, is it? What is a legal practitioner? A person whose occupation involves the giving of legal advice is actually quite narrow. I prefer a legally qualified person who may be in private practice or not, who may be in private practice, who lawfully provides a client with independent, confidential legal advice. I prefer the old one, particularly because we've widened the privilege under beyond the common law under 88.
Yeah, but the privilege of 88 does not refer to professional legal advice. It all hinges on who the person is rather than the context. The 88 will determine the context. And professional legal advice or who is the person. Those two elements are necessary. The fact that you broaden the content of what is protected doesn't mean that whatever the opening is that the person is protected. I mean, anything that smells like a legal relationship might be.
Yes, but you don't want somebody to try and claim privilege as a way of stopping information getting out. So that's why it is important that the person is actually a professional legal advisor as specified in the
form. I beg to differ. If clients believe him to be a professional legal advisor, even if he's not, clients must be protected, then you can go after the guy who's been to your advice about it. The new definition that you want is a professional, a legal practitioner. There's nothing about the legal in the person to see that.
No, I'm not very
professional.
Okay.
Can we
or a person of occupation, not profession.
They may with a legal practitioner, that's one thing. And then the second thing is different from the one. Or a person whose occupation involves the beginning of legal advice.
Can we do this? No, well, I'm going to put in an option because at the same time, like, we have 80 agencies at the moment who can drop the footnote. Then on the definition of professional legal advice, I put both these options. And you can put in your new one, the little footnote that you've got on the screen.
So you've got the study group and all those.
No, Mario, we can put the other screen, but we want
right.
to finish it off.
So you can then delete your option as well under 85. 89.
I think to report chain 90, a consequential amendment. 91, consequential amendments. Two consequential. 92, 10, 11, and 12 have been inserted now in the new 93, 1, 2, and 3. Mr. Chair, nearly copied there. 94, nothing to report. 95. Merely to indicate that there is an option under footnote 88 that was proposed by Dr. Ambrosini on the 24th of February, where that period of 3 days should rather be replaced with a period of 10 days. Consequential chair. 97, Mr. Chairman, merely consequential, except for, and that is something that, we would possibly like to still address the committee on. It's the whole question about 30 versus 180 days. That was mainly as a result of the Bremer case in Bahia, but questions have been raised whether it is appropriate here to allow for such a long period. So I think it's something that...
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the Bremer case but in detail, but basically a request for access to information, you need to make up your mind fast whether you're going to appeal, and you need to make up your mind whether you're going to appeal and get the information. Whether orders issued by the regulator, rights are being violated. Surely
yes.
That should be done as fast as possible, because my other question is, what happens? I mean, once you've appealed, presumably the whole thing is put on hold. You know, the enforcement notice has been issued that some action must stop. The responsible party wants to appeal. What happens in the 180 days? Can they carry on processing the information?
The enforcement doesn't kick in until the period expires. But yeah.
So definitely, yeah. Well, I just think that is a basis for saying no, this should remain 30 days.
There's now grown up an idea that the Bremer is hard and fast on the 180 days. It isn't so. Somebody made an extremely good argument. Was it not you? Here's the man. There's a misreading of the Bremer case, which Advocate Cronier can entertain us to his views, which I found extremely useful. And there's a misreading that people think, and we now routinely do it in other statutes, put in the 180 days. And
but the difference is, I just feel that, that this is different higher, because this is rights being violated, which you want to stop as soon as
that's
possible.
That's what it stands also.
So forget about Bremer and Paya. In terms of processing, the responsible party must decide quickly whether they want to appeal or not.
We are collapsing two different aspects, which I think ought to be kept separate. One is the right of appeal, and the other one is how soon the notice or the enforcement order is effective. And one could have that it is effective within 30 days unless appealed. But the power to appeal, especially for a variation, could be much longer. It could be 180 days. So that one brings himself in compliance in 30 days needs to bring himself in compliance, save for the right to go to court to ask for a stay of the order pending appeal. Then there is a judge who looks at the matter. But we could have a situation, especially when it comes to a variation of a notice, where somebody begins complying, and after a while he realizes that it's not possible, it's not fair, it's not right, because the first approach on the side of industries will be that of complying, then if they can't, they will fight it out. And reducing the possibility of fighting it out, I'm not pronouncing on the issue of constitutionality, I don't remember the cases I sit here, but it seems to be unfair, because you should always be able to go to court, because here it's a barring provision. You should always be able to go to court to appeal something that applies to you. Here there is an order, and you've got a barring provision that after X days you can no longer challenge the validity, and I don't think that that's right. Okay.
There's a whole provision for applying for variation, complying with blah blah blah. There are whole provisions for that.
Okay, so can you put in 30 days or 180 days as an option? With a little
I just wanted to say, like, if you're a responsible party, your time to appeal is 30 days. If you're a data subject, might have 180, because that's what PIA in the Bremer case tried to establish, that to protect your constitutional rights, whatever the reason might be, in this case your right to privacy, surely you must have an option. You won't always have the funds available to you, therefore longer time. But if you're the responsible party who's actually been accused of a breach, you must only have 30 days.
Report 98, nothing to report it. 99. Yes, sir, we might just wait for Dr. Anderson. Come back to that one, chair, because I didn't
come back to it, Daniel.
Also, 100, nothing to report. 101, nothing to report, Chair. 102, 103. 103A is a new proposal, Chair, and that's it. The offences that may be committed by witnesses in terms of the provisions whereby the regulator may subpoena or enforce the appearance of individuals before the regulator has provided for in clause 83, the new 83. Now,
wasn't that covered with reference to the
Commission? Yes, Chair, but we've come a long way since then, because at some stage we omitted the reference to section 6 of the Commissions Act, and then we realized that we have to have offences of this nature. The Section 6 of the Commissions Act is just worded a bit differently to what we propose here, but we can most probably revert back to 6 of the Commissions Act, a mere reference to Section 6 of the Commissions Act.
What is different here as well?
Mainly style, Chair, and then of course reference is to the regulator, where similar reference is to the Commission, and then of course we raise the question whether we shouldn't also include reference to the Enforcement Committee. But the elements of the offences, the various offences, are similar to each other.
So the Commissions Act is very old, so I don't have any problem with this going in. Obviously, if we have the Enforcement Committee, then it would need to apply to both the regulator and the Enforcement Committee. Except if you say regulator, does that not cover the Enforcement Committee?
We haven't got a provision in that regard, Jay. So it's either the one or the other.
All right, well, let's look at that. But I don't have a problem with you putting it in. Yeah.
Thank you, Jay. Then clauses 104 and 105 deal with the unique identifier.
You haven't changed that.
Offences, we haven't.
We've had that for a long time, yeah.
The only question now at this stage is, Chair, there may be an approach where one could consider deleting the reference to unique identifier and making these offences sort of applicable to any type of information processing which borders on the criminal. But that is something that one can
look, it was there because of the bank accounts and thefts of money, particularly from people without much money. So I would prefer to keep it as it is, specific.
It's just that if we, I think it's linked to the next the next page where we deal with the administrative fines. And if we have administrative fines, then this is fine, but if we don't have, it depends on what the decision is going to be regarding the administrative fines. If we don't have the administrative fines, which would actually deal with any sort of intervention, then it may be, because in usually, like for instance in the UK and so forth, it is an open section. It's not confined to the unique identifier.
You see, I've been thinking of administrative fines, and I quite like them from a point of view of this is a quick way to settle the matter, to pay the fine. But because the process hasn't been that exhaustive, if you don't want to pay the fine, then you must go to court and be prosecuted. But whereas the people who are messing around with people's bank account details, that really is criminal and must go to court. So I would rather keep them separate, because that is a problem. I don't know if it's just in this country or in other countries where people's bank account details are being given out, stolen, given out.
Yeah, but there's going to be a different crime.
And you know, and it's then used to raid their bank account, and there's really no excuse for that at all. So that's different from information as to your age being given out.
Mm. Yeah, but you see, Mr. Chairman, we keep using this type of references, but there you've got a complete different set of crimes. And the person who does it would be an accessory crime to fraud, theft, organized crime, racketeering.
No, but at the moment, people are selling bank accounts without any law stopping them, it would seem. That's why we are then creating a law.
Yeah, but it's an enforcement issue.
I don't know if you are thinking of keeping administrative fines, but then I have no problem with it. But it's just, if there's no administrative fine, then there wouldn't be, and you keep it only, you only leave it, you know, it's only in connection with unique identifiers, then if there is some sort of contravention which does not have anything to do with the unique identifier, but which is of a serious and persistent nature and it causes substantial damage, and the response party knew that it was a contravention and he failed to take any steps, etc., there would then be no
general
offence for that instance, for that case. So in that instance, the responsible party would not be held accountable. And that's really what is being used in other countries. You know, if you have a repeat offender and it's grossly, you know.
Why is it not covered by 183? Where you fail to comply with an enforcement notice.
Look, if you fail to comply with the enforcement notice, it is a lesser offence, because with this unlawful acts by unique identifier, the penalty is 1 million rand or imprisonment exceeding 10 years, and with the others it's only 1 year. And
where are the penalties for?
So this is really the 103 is for a first offender, or you know, but this is really where it's now very serious, and the person
103 is 10 years.
I think 10 years is only if you if it has an impact on the work of the regulator.
No, it's 103.1. The responsible party fails to comply with an enforcement notice and guilty of an offence. But you look at 106, section 103.1, to a fine of exceeding R1 million or such imprisonment on exceeding 10 years.
Sorry.
That was it. Was that a committee? Yes, Chief.
Sorry, that was a later addition. Well, if you think that it will be,
we could put a, I don't know, I mean that it's an offence not to comply with a enforcement purchase. So you don't want to make it. If I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying it's more of an offence not to repeatedly not to comply with an enforcement purchase. It doesn't make sense. It's already an offence. And obviously, you get more of a penalty and punishment if you repeatedly ignore it. So I don't sort of see the point. Whereas the unique identifier issue was a specific problem which was causing considerable hardship.
I think one should just be cautious that you do not, because the requirements are much higher in 104 than in 103. You know, in 103, if you don't comply with the enforcement, then you're guilty of an offence. And in terms of the new penalties, you can be fined for R1 million. But in terms of 104, it had to be a contravention of a serious, persistent nature, etc. All of those requirements are included, and then also the penalty is just the same. So then it doesn't really make sense.
At the previous meeting of the committee, when we first presented these offences to the committee, we did raise this. We said that these provisions, sub 2 especially, raises some concern. Because the first hurdle that the prosecuting authority will now have to get past is, even before you lay your charge, to prove that this is of a serious and persistent nature.
Would it not be settled by having an or instead of the and? So it's a serious and persistent nature, or likely to cause substantial damage or distress to the subject. So
the fact that somebody is selling your bank account is going to be likely to cause substantial damage or distress.
And this here is four, yeah.
You know, so it's an or. You've only got to find one of them.
Four substantial damage or distress. How
I think, you see, I think we must just look at this holistically, because we've sort of tampered with it so often that it's now sort of out of sync. Because the starting point was that you have a failure to comply with the enforcement or information notice, which is a first offence, and you get 1 year or 12 months. And then if you repeatedly, well, if... Let me rephrase it. For instance, in the UK, the system works like this. You have a first offence with your enforcement notice, and it's a fairly low penalty. And then if you repeatedly do that, and it's a serious and persistent nature, and this is where this wording comes from, then it becomes a bigger offence, and you have a larger penalty for that. And both 104 and 105 comes from the UK. We've just modified it to refer specifically only to unique identifier. And
yeah.
Now then we change the penalties so that the penalty is really high already for the first offender, and we've also now have the administrative fines. So I think we must just sort of look at the complete system of what we're trying to do, and then modify the penalties and everything and the requirements so that everything sort of flows.
And fortunately, the two of us all also have our differences, and may I just air mine, this is a loose standing offence. That's the bottom line for me. I think that would be my opinion, is that do we really need to have trappe van vergelijking?
And it is a loose standing offence.
First of all, the trappe van vergelijking, or whatever, the different steps of the acceleration of the penalties, it's not here anymore. Okay, so we don't have that system. What we wanted was people processing, selling people's bank account details. We wanted that to be an offence where you didn't have to go to the regulator to get an order made, which you then contravene. You go straight to court. Now, I don't know if a serious or persistent nature is necessary. What you want you want to distinguish between, well, you don't want to just say, well, you didn't look after the bank account details properly. You want to, it was specifically distributing bank account details. So you've got it just subject to Section 7, which is the whole of the conditions. Okay, and I don't think it needs to be the whole of the conditions. It is a question of you gave bank account details to people who were not entitled to them. So you apply for a debit order with a shop, they record your bank account detail. Someone in that shop then gives or sells, it doesn't matter which, those bank accounts to a third party, who then tries to phone the people and offer them things, and then someone just deducts from their bank account anyway. That's what's been happening. That's what we want to prevent. Now, my worry with the wording is that it's contravening the provisions of Section 7. So it's all the... as far as I can see it, it's all the processing conditions. The responsible party must ensure that the conditions set out are complied with. Whereas, you know, it might have been a minor... Well, okay, it's that. Then I think the serious persistent nature is not necessary. likely to cause substantial damage or distress is necessary, because, but you want to distinguish between in the bank, the people holding the bank account details, they took their file home and they left it on the bus or something. That's not what we're trying to, the harm we're trying to curb. So I don't think that cut and paste is necessarily what we wanted. We want to criminalize distributing bank account details of data subjects to people who are not entitled to them. That's basically it. So it's limited to that.
Well, what you're talking about really in 105 is the obtaining or the procurement of unique identity. And then the selling of things is in self-free.
Yeah, selling what could be all your.
But obtaining and procuring is also the crime.
Yeah.
And then you sell. And.
Can we.
And advertise.
Can we perhaps use the wording in 105 and just because 105 is about third parties, it's more like a hacking, and 104 is about the responsible party itself.
Mm.
So can we perhaps
the
use
bank or the shop not actually
yes, and
should that be criminalized?
Yes, and then 105 we can use the third. It's in connection with third parties, but can we perhaps use the wording in 105 and just do that for responsible party in 104? So just say, a responsible party,
well,
knowing you recklessly without the consent of responsible obtains or discloses you, blah, 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 blah.
You see, I understand now why the serious or persistent nature is there. And it then, because it is the responsible party and how they're looking after things, it then is actually correct. But the problem is, as Hank says, it's quite a hurdle to... it's quite a hurdle to overcome. So is 104 necessary? Should we not just be going with 105?
Mm-hmm.
Because 104 is really something that the regulator can deal with. Processing, so they can look at the systems of the bank or the shop that had all these accounts, and they can deal with it that way. Because 104 is more negligence. People didn't have the right systems in place.
And that's
105 is the problem.
But isn't it that you actually wanted this offence that you didn't have to go through all the enforcement and all the usual procedures, that you want to go straight
for?
No,
we wanted that for 105. We wanted the dissemination, the collation, obtaining. You see, the problem with 105 is only the third party. What we want to also criminalise is where the responsible party, they're not just negligent is not so bad. What we want to criminalise is they give out the bank account details, or some staff member gives them out. So they've got wonderful systems, but a staff member gives it out. So it's not just the third party who takes the bank account details, it's actually also the staff member who gave them the
sole But
105
is
the
third party.
Do,
yes,
did you read that into 105? The worker.
Any person.
Not in 104, because I think that was the original intention.
But that's why I suggested.
Your problem with 105 is third party. I think it reads fine, but because you've got third parties, then it limits it not to the bank employer.
But can you not, that's why what I suggested is can't you use the wording in 105 and just say a responsible party or any other person knowingly or recklessly without the consent, blah, 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 and
yeah,
then go on.
Yeah.
Well, no, but you see, because it is, it's obtained or discloses or procures, it also is gives or distributes or disseminates.
You don't just give or disseminate, they're going to sell.
They will probably sell, but it won't be your sister's child works at the bank. Okay? They give you the you run a business selling various things and you want to phone people. And they you could have a situation where they give the relative. So it's not just selling. Probably they will try and sell, but it could also you do need to cover the give situation. So look, I think it's basically what we're saying is we don't want, for the responsible party, we're not so concerned with criminalizing negligence as to how their systems are operating. That can be dealt with by the regulator. What we want to criminalize is more what is in 105 under third parties, but we also want to include the responsible party deliberately giving out or selling the unique identifying the details. So you could, I think, collapse it into one force.
No, I'm just going to choose. Because one is going to pivot on a person, and the other one is going to pivot on a responsible party. But it's going to be different from 104 now.
So is 104 then just going to be the responsible party who knowingly...
Knowingly.
But we want to narrow it. 104 is too wide, apparently.
I just want to clarify, because you will have to say that it's unlawfully, because otherwise, I mean, a person knowingly or recklessly without the consent of the person obtains and discloses that... because it's a third party, but I mean a responsible party needs to obtain I just want to clarify, would you still maybe just delete subsection 104, 2 and 3 and leave the contravenes the provisions of section 7, because you need to show that it's unlawful.
Yep. Section 7 is just too wide to make it a crime.
Section 7 is the weakest.
Yes, but it draws in, you know, you draw it in when you refer to as it relates to the processing of a unique identifier.
Mm-hmm. But still, I think my problem is with 104.1. That's why 2 becomes necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must be of a serious
system nature and cause substantial damage or distress.
Would you be satisfied if you say a responsible party who unlawfully obtains or discloses a unique identifier of a data subject or procures the disclosure of a unique identifier of a data to another person?
Where is the law that you can't disclose a unique identifier? Where is it what makes it unlawful?
Well, if that is when you're not complying with the PPI board.
It's not unlawful for the way to be enforced the law and the way it's not
maybe not really assist you, but are you at least satisfied with the definition of unique identifier?
Yes. Look, coming to full circle, maybe 104 isn't too bad for you. Because you see, 104.1 is wide.
Right.
104.2 then does limit it.
Okay.
It will make it very difficult to prove. I mean, you could still change the and to all. Yeah, maybe it's just the even as it is a change to the and to all.
Chair, I would just like to draw your attention to clause 99. I'm just going back, Chair, but I'd just like to highlight.
Before we get to, we want to go back to the clause mayor, and I'll see if there's no, let's just finish this, please. Oh, sorry. 106. Not involved in the trafficking bill. But in the trafficking bill, well, not actually involved in the trafficking bill, sorry. And Dr. Amasinia doesn't need to be.
And I'm not involved at all.
The issue basically that's come up with in the trafficking bill is fines and prison sentences. And the proposals from the NPA on huge fines of like millions are there for, and basically where the commitment is heading. Not to specify fines, but to rather look at the maximum term of imprisonment being a guide for what the fine should be. And I'm just worried about passing a piece of legislation at the same time, which is completely disproportionate to some of the earlier discussions. So I suppose it is really what I'm saying is and getting other two members haven't really been part of these discussions. Are you there? Okay. But then just to say to find or a term of imprisonment not exceeding 12 months or 10 years or whatever. R1 million. R1 million.
I tend to agree there because if you look at the sort of most of these companies that are actually processing personal information will go from a risk-based approach, and they'll say like a fine of $1 million and I can make like $15 million in this instance, and they will then just go and like pay the fine at the end of the day because this would be absolutely nothing to them, and the bill in itself will then have absolutely no teeth. But it will be not that easy for a magistrate to send somebody to court if you then have to incorporate King 3 and see which director is actually going to land up in court. It actually sounds simpler than what it is. So I think it's important to leave the fines open, and maybe also on the issue of administrative fines. I also wonder if they're the same, because if you look, for instance, at your competition tribunals, I'm not saying that you must go and charge a percentage of somebody's annual turnover, but those fines have actually made people pay attention. If you look at the work that's lately been done. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
The Minister finds that to deal with this issue under the penalties, do we have, do we specify the R1 million, or do we just say fine or turn the maximum?
Well, I think that if we are moving for consistency, not to specify the, I mean, we are the same committee, we shouldn't. But the... See, I just want to have a word of caution, because one looks at the worst possible case scenario. This is not a trafficking bill where each type of trafficking is bad, it's hideous, it's horrendous. Here, the type of range of activities go to the very damaging, to the not-so-damaging. And the regulator will be forced to convict a few people just for being negligent, for not having been that careful, sloppy, just to get the word out. I mean, at the end, all that which results in real damages is likely to be associated with another crime, whether it's fraud, whether it's theft. What we are protecting in this bill is privacy. So the damage, as important as it might be, is still a damage to privacy, not to the finances or to the physical integrity of a person.
So what are you saying?
No, I said let's not have the attitude of having these draconian sanctions. I mean, 10 years also seems to be very, very high.
Well, as Javier has said, you may, penalties are not potentially that's strong enough. You can just have them, the money paid, time paid.
Yeah, I know that would. The option, I don't have a problem with not having the option of a fine. But 5 years, there is no director of any company out there who will take the risk of going to jail for 5 years. They will monetize a financial fine, and I agree. And this bill applies to the big guys and applies to the small guys. But they will, 5 years, that would be more than sufficient for a violation of the right to privacy, not for theft of things, because that's what this bill is about.
No, it may be repeat, you may want it to be the cut-off calculation, where it is your third offense. It maybe should be a 15 years.
So the third offense would be 15 years, okay?
Third offense would be...
If it's the third offense, you get convicted 3 times.
No, because the first 2 offenses you got fined. Look, unless you want, I don't want to...
No, okay. I'm sorry.
Our agreement is we don't want to lose the R1 million, we keep the service of prisoners. And they stop out to see one option.
No, Frank.
Okay. All right, do you want to then go back to the overwhelming force of nature?
Yes, Chair. Yes. Let me just put our down.
99.
No other word in the English language than force majeure. All the terrible things are said in French in the English language.
We're more concerned about what we have in brackets at this stage.
Why
the committee. All right, we'll do that.
So my problem is they're trying to produce legislation that people understand.
But not, this is not the deal.
Ask a simple question. We've been asked many questions. So I would like to maybe, if I may, ask a question. Anyone would like to answer that, and that is, why do we need, I mean, force majeure is a question of impossibilium est, bottom line, why do we need to insert a defense which will always be applicable? The legislature cannot exclude force majeure ever. And that is a defense, by default. But my question is, so why should we refer to a common law default defense in any event? Why shouldn't we?
Why do you only raise this now?
I think the answer is...
No, but also see that there is a difficulty. Had it not been there in the first place, I would agree, but as you know, anything which gets taken out by a bill, in a bill, through the work of the committee, could be given interpretative value. In case of an ambiguity, you can go to the preparatory papers, and it was there, it's been taken out during committee.
Chair, the bottom line question is it possible for the legislature to exclude force majeure by means of legislation ever as a defense?
Well, actually, yes. In terms of a criminal culpability, no. But in terms, often not, but not always, there are a great deal of crimes out there, especially in the environmental field, which are irrespective of responsibility, objectively. And in terms of administrative sanction, you could. It doesn't matter what happened, it's objective responsibility, absolute. And these are the type of things where it could be construed. What harm is done? We're just getting all our upset because it's an English word derived from the French language, so is douche. So it's all sorts of things that we use constantly.
Yes. The only question remains is whether we should keep the wording in brackets here and whether the committee is satisfied with the wording.
Not even the, I mean, the force majeure, it's something that will not be reasonable to resist.
Okay, I'm the same language person. I would agree that
you
try
a little bit.
Chair, this is something that I haven't disclosed to the committee. When I did a word search, I actually found reference only to force majeure. I was surprised why I didn't get reference to Wiesmeyer, but then the question was...
I thought I have only seen
More, yes, Jay. I think there's only, in any event, I think between 5 and 9 references in other legislation, and that includes legislation which is not in force anymore. And that is why one really starts thinking, but why should you? But in any event, I think my question has been answered. I'll delete the words in brackets, Jay, and leave it with force majeure.
What is in the textbooks, what term is used? This. Yeah. I mean, if this is used, then this is what you're saying. I haven't come across, I mean, I'm not that familiar, but I
especially in the shipping law, Jay, force majeure.
So this is not about shipping. I mean, that might be influenced by French treaties or whatever. In our common law textbooks, in our textbooks describing the common law, if they use this major, then shouldn't that be what we use? Ananda, when you use the old came from the law commission, you use this. Why do you use this, not force?
You read it in the textbooks.
I would rather have said, let's go back to what it was. If you're going to have a term, let's go for the Latin in the textbooks. Mario doesn't come here because
Chair, but yes, in the introduced version of the, or the recommended version by the Law Reform Commission, they spelled it M-A-J-O-R. We changed, CISA and I changed the spelling to M-A-I-O-R.
We will go with you.
Why did you change it? Because we were of the opinion that you spell the Latin word.
Okay, it is in the Latin, we use the Latin. Ananda, do you know what to tell us why you put J and why you changed the Latin language? We did for more than a millennia. Okay, so we're keeping it as this major as in the introduced book. Okay. To be fair, you will look at what is the correct spelling, whether it's with a J or an I, and put whatever that one is. Okay, then we move on. We're now on the administrative fines.
Yes, Chair, thank you. Clause 107, capital A, Chair. Chair, I think we were able to capture the discussions of the committee to the extent that we aim to design the system where if the regulator or if a responsible party does not comply with an enforcement notice,
which is then determined to be an offence in terms of section 103, the regulator may submit an infringement notice or deliver an infringement notice to that responsible party, and the responsible party then has an option to either pay an administrative fine to the regulator, or if he or she does not want to pay the administrative fine, then the provisions of section 103 automatically kicks in and the responsible party, a prosecution must be instituted against the responsible party. The system introduced here is very similar to the Firearms Control Act, where it's actually the responsible party who decides whether he wants to be prosecuted or simply pay the administrative fine, which will then not result in a previous conviction.
Excuse me, Chair. Yeah. I just want to come back to that, and I know you said we're going to skip it to now. Once again, if we limit it to a specific amount, 1 million rand, you know, that means in 5 years' time we have to go and amend legislation again.
The ratio between the amount of the number of years that the regional court can impose and their prescribed minimum fines that they.
No, but this is
I doubt it. I doubt it. Sure.
Look, the only thing there, I mean, I think this is a sort of expeditious way of dealing with the problem, giving everyone the option to pay the fine, or the person if they're not happy can go to court. So you do want to set some limits, I think. I hear what you're saying, what you said earlier around if the amount comes too little and they're somewhat accepted. Although I suppose the thing may be to say that the minister by regulation can increase it.
If I may, Chair, I just want to give you an example. I'm a citizen adjudicator at WASPA, and what we've done there is not limit the fines, because what we found is that these service providers just paid the fines. They don't have like any problem, they continue with their breaches because they work it into their sort of, as I mentioned earlier, their whole risk methodology. And it's absolutely, 1 million rand sounds a lot to us, but for these people it's absolutely nothing. I mean, they sometimes have a turnover of up to 50 million in a week. So for them to lose 1 million, and then if you count with it, the whole procedure is another 30 days. So in that 30 days, I can build in my risk and keep on, you know, like acting contradictionary to whatever the administrative fine is going to be, because I know I will probably only have to pay this fine after I've gone through this whole process, which is probably going to be 30 days from after I've gotten the notice. Then I have the option to go to court. So you look at 6 months, they can build a million rand into 6 months of their budget. That's basically
Mr. Chairman, the regulator has the choice. It's a May provision. So it may simply put decide whether or not to settle a case, because it's not one of those that you're referring to, or try to put the people in jail. And none of them will want to be in jail. So, I mean, no matter how much money they're making.
Where did you get the figure of million?
It was a proposal, but...
On what basis? Was it from the firearms?
No, Chair. That was merely just a proposal at this stage from our side, if I remember correctly. But maybe I should just... It looks like Ananda, but I would also like to say something, Chair. But
we'll say,
and I'm just scared that I'm going to forget it, but we must consider together with the scenario that civil claim is also open, and it will be much more good to get a stiff judgment in your case or in your favor civilly for the person who actually suffered the damage, number one. Number two, in the legislation where you have these humongous administrative fines, the majority of those processes actually, or the administrative fine actually led or was based on an agreement. For example, the Consumer Protection Act. It's actually, I just forgot the technical term, but it's consent. It's consent orders. That's actually what happens, and that's why they are paid. The R1 million can also be replaced with something like R1 million for each day that you do not that you contravene. The 10% thing, annual turnover, that in my view is becoming tricky, because we've also had a look at the formulas, and some of them are to try and define what your annual turnover is. Now you have to decide whether if this is an international company, if it operates locally and internationally, and where does it derive its income from, international business, and it becomes hectic. Keep it straight and simple, Chair. This is not the priority. The proposal, which is not included in this clause at this stage, is that this should also be a form of income for the regulator. No.
I think Henk has covered what I wanted to say. I think we looked in the NCA, because that is where the R1 million comes from. But what they actually say is it may not exceed the greater of 10% of the respondent's annual turnover during the preceding financial year or R1 million. So.
Now, I think Hank just said that this will be a source of financing for the regulators.
No,
48B, we're talking about fees, not fines.
This was basically a proposal because we're told that internationally people are moving to the fines on protection violations. So it's very much an option at this stage, but it was seen as a sort of expeditious, so if there's no administrative fine, you go to court, and it's an option on the regulator. I personally, R1 million seems a little bit low. But it's from what period? I would have thought maybe make it 10, and then have a provision under the regulation that the minister may increase that amount.
I don't want to think you can say.
Unless we create parameters, increased by the CPI, increased by something, you can't just have an unfettered power to the minister to determine what the regulations are. I mean, what the fines are by regulations. What if it comes to R1 billion? I mean,
Chair, would you then suggest the R1 million plus that? Yeah, well, I mean, that's the whole issue. You look at all these things and you look at the amount of information. So, like, for instance, with a subscription service, how many people are actually targeted. Like, if you have the smaller players, what they will usually do is they will only make use of media in newspapers and those sort of things, while you have the big players, they make use of television, so their sort of return on their advertisements are much bigger. hence the fact then that their fines will also be bigger, because you take a lot of things into consideration before you issue a sanction. But they vary in size. But that's the whole concern. If you have like a small player, let's say you have a doctor that breaches this act and he's got like, oh well, I don't know how many patients, say like for instance he will have, and then you have a hospital on the other side. Now surely you can't, you know, like have them under the same sort of fines. There must be a bigger margin, and that's why I think maybe that's a good suggestion.
Okay, so can we keep it in large as is with the 10 million and the provision under the regulations is going to increase it in line with inflation, CPI. Okay.
Okay, so we do not need to insert a provision like that, but these funds will then be deposited into the National Revenue Fund.
Okay.
Sorry, Chair, I just want to confirm then the penalties will be open and the administrative fine would be limited to 10 million.
Thank you, Chair. General provisions, amendment of laws, a consequential amendment. The fees provision hasn't changed since the committee last had a look at it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I just had one issue there, the must. I would rather have had, this is an empowering provision. It's going to be quite a controversial provision if it's put into practice. I would rather the minister having an option of making it made, particularly where they may be generating funds through this.
If it is subject to subsection 2, and then in 2 it says the regulator may only request the minister to prescribe an annual administrative fee after a period of 3 years, blah blah blah. So that changes actually. You must do it, but the may changes the must.
No, I mean even they. The part subsection 2. Okay, the regulator may only request after. So that's just the time limit. Once that time has elapsed, the regulator can start instituting fines. I mean fees rather. Okay. I'm saying that should be a political decision. So it should be the minister may, not the must.
Thank you, Chair. Then, Mrs. Smith.
I just wanted to add, isn't this that we thought that this may come into play when the regulator finds that the minister or the government is really not providing enough funds and sort of trying to keep the infringe the independence of the regulator, and that, you know, this if you say you may do that, then, you know, that will be exactly the same. You will have the same effect, because that is really, if you have too little funds to really properly function properly. This should help the independence of the regulator, to assist the independence of the regulator. But if the minister is not under any obligation and that minister is not in favour of the regulator, then the minister will also not provide the regulator with any extra funds. Then it defeats the object of the whole idea of getting extra funds.
But it is, you see, my difficulty is it is I mean, this is going to be got from the private sector anyway, not really from less so from government, if possible, and it is a big political issue. which I don't think should be, I think the minister should have a discretion. I mean, obviously, if the regulator wants fees and the minister doesn't want to give them, it's going to be a debate in Parliament in the public domain. So you've got that kind of protection. But my fear is just given that they can go wild, the regulator, and the minister has no choice, he has to prescribe the fines. I can see enormous problems there.
So what would be the purpose of the fines then? Because then it's not really necessary to have the section if the regulator can just ask for more money in Parliament.
Well, maybe it might not be more money in the state, in the purse. So it would be a thing of, I would have seen it more as an option of the regulator and the executive together saying, okay, we don't have enough money for you. You can therefore start imposing fines. Fees. That it's done jointly.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 110, regulations. We've got.
It seems that my option is included in the third option.
Yours is the only alternative that survived. I remember saying that I would go with option 3.
Yeah, but that option 3 is
Jones.
Correct. Yeah, and mine is included in Jones.
Mine is option 2 and yours is option 1.
Yeah, but option 1 and option 3 are effectively the same, just that then it's spelled out the subject matter.
Well, it sounds like we can withdraw both of them.
Yeah. It's painful to agree with John.
Option 1 and option 2 go. Okay. And we've established that I mean, does ICASA make regulations?
That's what it does in that.
Okay, alright.
Chidi, just as a matter of clarity, then we'll just indicate the proposed amendment of the original 102, the new 110, and then just include the redraft without referring it to an option. And then, right, clause 111 is the procedure for making the regulations. If I remember correctly, Chair, this is also something that we have previously submitted to the committee.
I discussed at the time the possibility of considering a notice and comment stage, which is partially captured in this language. The difference being that with the notice and comment stage, you publish the draft, you get the comments, you consider the comments, you publish a final regulation together with the comments, summarized as you may wish to do, indicating where whether you follow the comments, whether you didn't, and why. So effectively the final regulation becomes a record of the entire decision-making process, which could be subjected to judicial review, if arbitrary and capricious.
Well, I wanted more hearings of those things. It appears somewhere in the footnote. But I mean, that's what you described as the ideal, but then with more of the hearings for all interested parties, because you may have consumer NGOs who also have views. So you don't consult them in your circles that well. But, I mean, I don't think there are options in that go through. Well, if you want to write an option, mind if you're in here somewhere.
Yeah, right, the option. I was suggesting what was done in the Immigration Act, which worked out quite well until it was amended.
Yeah, mine's based on the example.
I'm happy with what's there. If they want options, they can have options. They want options, then. Conditional arrangements.
Thank you, Chief.
mean, the I saw the Bursa submission, which was 2 years and 5 years. 3 years and 5 years. The setting up of the regulator, will that, how long does government have to do that? Like a year? Or is this the year only relating to processing once the regulator is approved?
Yes, Chair. Strictly speaking, before the Act is implemented, the Act comes into operation now. It's debatable when the Act comes into operation. That's why it's always safer to rather refer to certain chapters. But the bottom line is, and this is purely speculation, Chair, because if we now look at the procedure that must be followed in order to get the regulator appointed, it might be a procedure that could be quickly done, or it might be something that can be a bit tedious and take time. So,
because if the commencement is on a date to be determined by the President, so that's open, and different dates may be determined in respect to different provisions, so you've got that to begin with. I don't know, I mean, this is not new law. I'm happy with the language because it stands 1 year, 3 years, at maximum 3 years extension.
Yes, no, I'm not in trying to give them space, because we all know that we have the biggest enterprises are dragging their feet and are calculating that we will take forever to finish this thing. And they all know perfectly well, they've known for years, they've come from the
year. We know 4 years from the date the Act comes into effect. The Act will take some time to come into effect.
The Chairman, 3 points, if I may. First of all, as a general point, nobody brings in compliance with the bill. Everyone waits for the thing to come, and then looks at what it looks like. Secondly, bringing oneself in compliance means to adopt computers, security standards, etc., which will be developed by the regulators. There are going to be SAPS standards, what fits, what does not fit. It's going to be a very complex regulatory process. You don't go out there and get yourself an 8 million rand computer program to handle all this until you know exactly what it is. This is going to take time. Then you need to train the people to use it. You need to set up procedures.
Yeah, it's
all right. It's okay.
Okay.
I mean, we've had
opinions so,
from all...
I was talking out of common sense. I'm glad that they put it. But
difficult thing. I'm automatically looking in the direction of Ananda. But I would at the same time possibly just request your indulgence if we could please request 5 or 10 minute break.
Yeah, we're going to go for it.
We're going to finish.
But this is the last section.
Whatever he calls, I'm going to say. information
What time tomorrow is meeting?
9.
Oh. You're earning your salary, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and when are you guys going to announce the people for this call? Super Dimly is so stressed now. He's so stressed about it. Super Dimly. Yeah, he's stressed out about
it. If you're looking for a job, you look for a job. But don't target in our
way.
And on law, for some reason, every now and then when the interview is there, but doesn't get you. So I think maybe you must just take a break now and focus on the answer.
Yeah.
If you're tentative, I go on the way.
No, you own them, but I'm not going to submit them.
Why not?
No, because this is my own one.
Where was the other one? Is it that one?
Yeah, it's on. Yeah. Okay, I'll ask you to wait till it's here.
Huh?
I'll ask you to wait till it's here.
No, but I'm just saying. That's my own
account. 324, no, I'll give you.
Yeah, well, I understand, but maybe Imali might be way better than what other companies are offering.
Even other departments.
Yeah. Focus a lot on.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've been applying for the past 3 or 4 years without a good luck, don't know if I should say give up or
what. Yeah. It's the same as Zahida. 5 years.
Yeah,
I don't know. And who do Zahida need to weigh in on?
Yeah.
And at that time, I'm going to be harmed.
And even then, I'm like, I'm going together. Whether I was applying or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, tell you what you are. I only apply twice.
You only apply twice?
Yeah. Because now, we apply for this one. If it doesn't get it, then what would be the point of maybe for an interview? Let's say next year, they are the time for the commission interview. And you can't get it in your position. Why would all of you want to stay now? Anyway, maybe sometimes you might argue about talking, they don't take you for the senior one or the junior one because they're overqualified. Is that the case?
Yeah, no, but it's true what you're saying. So we just see from the curtain. So it's this week.
No, I'm 20, maybe 24th.
24th meetings.
Mm. But I'm thinking with like in that week of the 24th, I'm likely to cancel some of the meetings.
Are
we ready? Because we don't we might go over since that point. So if I go over since that point,
it will be so cool.
Yeah.
Amendments, so is there anything ready for us to look at?
Not really.
Is there anything you want us to draw attention to?
It looks like we'll have to return to the committee in any event again with a further draft, but not at this stage.
No, we'll get on to that this draft anyway.
Not at this stage, Jerry, but as Dr. Ambrosini also indicated, these things are technical and one would just like to have a final look at them. But I can't remember whether we had anything specifically.
Tones or voice message alerts say about their character.
You might have just added it was my spouse that.
So you're saying that on page 67, the amendment to the National Credit Act, that is not.
As far as we're concerned, there are no problems with it. The highlighted areas are just consequential amendments that came about as a result of the Consumer Protection Act, Consumer Protection Act's amendments, consequential amendments. So it's actually consequential amendments on consequential amendments. So the only thing is that you know that there has been some views aired by the National Credit Regulator. But that was some time ago, and I don't know whether that has been solved or not.
So we're basically saying, look, this bill will be presented to these amendments to other laws are consequential, they're not due. Members can look again in their own time, and the higher amendment. Why are we putting here as opposed to the schedule? Is that because they're used?
No, Chair, it's a question of just taking up too much space for the committee to have a look at it for the first time. So,
we're on page 69. It's called in part 4, deal against decision and complaints to the regulator.
And there are two models.
There are two models. Now, as far as I understand, the only difference between the two models is 77J.
That is correct, Chief.
Rather than having to reproduce them, why can't you just reproduce it and then have a different title? No, the title would be even the same, and then you would just have 277J as two options.
We can do that for you, Mr. Chair.
The mandatory option or the recommendation?
the question of a recommendation notice or an enforcement notice? We're at the back, we're on the amendment to part 4, quite higher, chapter 1A.
And it gives the regulator, the information regulator, a very limited and modest role in dealing with the refusal of the fire request.
Or an enforcement notice, not modest. Anyway, but the issue is that you're just going to then have 77J repeated with two options.
And also K.
A K, if you follow this much as one, you would have a K division. And then the application to court is the same.
Yes, Chair. Can't say no, you're on the chair. You know, you need to pretend to be civilized when you're on the chair. And I'm just tasting it. Probably I know the answer through you, Mr. Chairman. But why don't we just make the provisions of this bill applicable to PAIA exactly the same processes? Because after all, divulging information which shouldn't be divulged and withholding information which should be divulged, which should be accessed to, seem to be two sides of the same effort.
Chair, our approach was from the beginning when we started looking at these things to recognize that in our view there is a difference between PAIA disputes and PPI disputes. PAIA disputes actually relate only to three things. Your request has been denied, if you're a requester, or the alternative thing, the request has been granted, if you're a third party and you have to complain against that. And then it's a question of condemnation and fees, access fees. Strictly speaking, it's a simple process. It's one document. And the question with regard to that document or record is, did the information officer or the head of the private body act in accordance with the grounds for refusal? And that, in short, is a dispute that can arise from PAIA. The question is, do you really need to have all those extensive powers of the regulator in terms of which he or she now can subpoena people and go to the place and search for a document? And we simply thought that is not appropriate to do it in that way, and rather to limit it and scale it down to something that will or powers that will be more appropriate with reference to PAIA disputes.
Okay, but I don't think, can we take it any further at this point? I don't think so.
Chair, I just wanted, and I apologize for interrupting you. There's just one concern that I have, and I think it was my mistake, and I would like to not give a final answer at this stage. I'm just drawing your attention to it. I think Ananda and I will have to discuss it again. But if you look at the two options, both of them are similar to the extent that if a request for access to a record was refused, for example, then you've got a choice of three ports of entry, either the internal appeal or the information regulator or the court. Now, if all of us understand it like that, I think there might be a problem with our clauses 77A, because there, and it relates to complaints to the regulator. In sub A, we say a requester that has been unsuccessful in an internal appeal to the relevant authority. Strictly speaking, according to our model, that person must be able to go directly to the board. So I apologize, and I'm just highlighting that for the committee. We will have to just make sure that portion is in line with the model.
But should it not be
the case that once they've been unsuccessful on internal appeal, they could also approach the regulator?
that is where the question arises, is do we need to build in an extra hurdle for a person who requests access to a record of a public body, because internal appeals are only available in respect of certain public bodies. Now you're building in an extra hurdle. After your internal appeal, you have to go to the regulator, and only after you've received the regulator's response, you may approach the court. And that was, of course, in line with another option that we presented to the committee in that big document of ours. But we think that the providing the person of an option with regard to three ports of entry option is actually the most streamlined.
Yeah, but organogram is right. It's the phrase in the 77A.
Okay. Wrapping up. Yeah.
Can I just ask, I didn't if it is possible, if we could include this in and just do what Dr. Amasini has suggested, would you like it to be like that, or would you prefer that it, because the structure at the moment says that the regulator will regulate the processing of the protection of personal information in terms of PPI Bill and the access to information in terms of FIRE. So, and then this follows from there that you do the one in the one, so the regulator will regulate two bills and they will be fully functional in, but it is possible to maybe include it in one, but will there be any purpose in doing that?
I prefer it as it is, so that when PIRE is amended and the little booklet on PIRE is published, it's all there. Okay. And
it's a lot of work, right? I did a run through it once, just this month ago. It's quite a lot of work. Maybe you've done it already with your offering. But to write it in the right places.
Yeah, mine is not so much whether you can do it or not. It's more just the ease for public bureaucrats, whatever, to have it, rather than one act which they think doesn't apply to them, and then, you know, it all gets worse.
And then just the final word from my side, if I may, just to note that there are other provisions in PAHIA that would require consequential amendments. So we'll have to give attention to that as well.
All right, then trying to get a way forward. We've still got to deal with children, and I'll come back to that. But for the rest, you've got then what you can produce into version 6, and version 6 would be what we present to the full committee. When we present it, and I don't know how long that will take you, but a costing of the changes we've made on the regulator would be needed. You've got some documents from 209 on the costing. There was a whole lot of stuff that was presented then costing of the implementation of PPI, 27th of October 209. I don't know how accurate they were, but at least the changes, the additions that we are making with the increased number of full-time people and the enforcement committee, what additional money are you looking at for that? So that's, I would like to have that when we present it, and we then need to also have further political consultations. I need to take it to my study group. I need to take it to caucus. The same may apply to members of the other parties, but you may be less concerned with the cost of implementation.
No. Cost of regulatory practices.
Okay.
Right, and that 2009 thing was equivalent.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, then we've got a deal. Sorry, Mario.
I know it's difficult, but regulatory impact assessment, is there a way of, for us as a government, as a parliament, having a reading of how much this will cost South Africa as a whole? Because these are tough times.
Look, we had two of the large bank groupings giving completely different figures as to how much it would cost them. So,
You have one thing in the permission.
There's omissions. One came with a huge number and the other had sort of came with a small number.
Then there's the children.
Which we are nowhere close to, we're not close to completing. And I don't know how we tackle that issue. And we do really have to finish that issue, much as I would have liked this to have been the very last meeting. We do have to finish that issue before we take it to the full committee. What I think you need to do is look at, again, some options, some proposals. You've heard that there's not great eagerness, or there isn't any great eagerness to reduce the age to 13, because that's arbitrary. You could delete section 20, clause 25.1, but 25.1 actually helps 10. Otherwise, if you don't have 25.1, then you've got a problem of the data subjects. They can only processing may only be personal information may only be processed if the data subject consents. What happens with the child and consent is all extremely confusing. So I think that points to the fact that there does need to be a provision for children. And it does need to provide, as you tried to in 25.1, for a competent person and consent where, where the child is competent, processing is necessary, was it that one? You know, it was the issue of where the child, I'm looking at the wrong section, sorry, circumstances where the child is not legally competent. I think those help. It's a question then of we'd like, both Ms. Smuts and I see the regulator as playing a role. It may be too onerous on the regulator to have to approve every applicant who wants to process information relating to a child, so maybe the issue of regulations which specify that in greater detail may help that. But we need some more options. I think it would be good if you can come up with something and then circulate it via email. But we may have to meet to discuss it.
I still think that the way to do it is for us to meet separately. Say even the evening before we have the meeting with the full committee, or the afternoon before. We have the meeting, so that Henkin and Ananda are here in town for the meeting with the full committee. So that we don't yet again have a separate, you know, we meet 1 week and 2 weeks later we meet with the full committee.
I mean, luckily, 25 and 26 will remain, so it won't affect the structure of your bill. So even if they give a view of the meeting 25-1, the rest of 25 will remain, so it won't throw your numbering out. I don't think we will get this bill in the House this year. We've got about two or 3 weeks.
Not if our colleagues want to read it.
Yeah.
I mean, this takes...
The IFP team, is it?
To read it. No, I'm not talking about colleagues in our committee.
Yeah,
I mean, it's...
I mean,
this is hundreds of pages.
I don't know, one needs to discuss with the chair whether, I mean, it would be nice for the committee to have finalized before the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's going to be possible, but I think, what else are you, the two of you, doing?
We would prefer to exercise the right to silence, but if I could possibly answer that question in a different manner, is to say to you that the costing is the major exercise at this stage, and it is unfortunately going to take time. We can take a chance and try and play around with the figures ourselves, but we need to get guidance from our CFO they should also have a re-look at that costing exercise, because it's a question of funds being made available, etc.
Is it possible? I understand the concern, but it's not possible to, you're trying to say now, but complete the bill in committee by that week, the week of that, which is second, third, fourth. I just don't want us to stand over till next year and deal with the costing aspect in the year after.
No, well, look, once we finalise the bill of the committee, then it's finalised. Look, I don't know. You did a costing exercise, a very thorough one. It may be a question of updating that. But then the provisions that we've put in are not that, well, they are quite drastic, but they're quite ring-fenceable. So it's now, instead of one full-time commissioner, it is now three, and the possibility of more. What is the cost of an extra full-time commissioner as opposed to a part-time? It shouldn't be difficult to work that out. What will the cost be of the enforcement committee? Those are the two key areas, really.
And then, of course, extended paia powers.
What will the cost of the extended paia powers be? But how much in addition is that? It would be a bit more work, but how much really? And then you'd presumably save court time elsewhere.
Yeah, I can give you those estimates tomorrow morning. I'll take it on myself. But that was a document that was prepared by consultants. Although it's a departmental document, it was consultants that prepared that document. And I mean, irrespective of whether they are requested to do it again or whatever, but our CFO will have to be involved, and that takes a bit of time.
Speak
to the DG.
All right, well, I think that's it for now. So
please,
if you can...
Just stay longer. No, I don't. Thank you. But, no, I need to give them a couple of language on a couple of things. The first one, I need to decide on those options under the exclusion clause. Then the language on the notice provision. And there were three or four more. May I be given a deadline?
Tomorrow.
No. Come, seriously. Mm-hmm. A serious deadline.
What else are you doing?
Do you want to know?
The section of the extent information you're not dealing with anymore.
Sure.
You're resigning from some other structures that you're involved with.
I'm sure that it gives immense pleasure, doesn't it? He forced me to resign from this. Of course he did.
Yeah. So basically, Mario, as soon as possible.
Okay, can I do it by Monday next week? By next Monday, basically a week from today.
Gee, we've been given a week for the costing document, and we'll be able... There's not much, if I remember correctly, that we need to beef up with regard to this version of the bill. But here and there you get a glitch, and it will take some time, but we'll be able to most probably have a sixth version ready by... if we work fast, and I mean, I don't mean that sarcastically, from our side, next week, Tuesday.
Okay, so I'll give it to you by Saturday?
Tuesday morning, because strictly speaking, it's just a question of me copying and pasting into the document.
Okay, thank you. That's the most kind of you. You're a reasonable man, that you should go into politics.
All right. Just got to interrupt this in the committee and announce it. Terrible this month, and then you have to come back to it.
If we don't manage it, we can have a revision session.
Gee, maybe just one question. Until when is the committee going to sit? I've been given the date of 9 December. Is that correct?
No. We have a plan to study for last week of November.